So hello everybody, welcome to High Notes in what I think is week 5 of our 2020 virtual season on August 3rd. We're delighted to have with us today the brilliant pianist Jeremy Denk, who will be performing with Stefan Yakiv this coming Sunday in our series, and Jeremy will be joining us a bit later in this show. And also two beloved members of the Aspen faculty, Nancy Allen and Elaine Duvas, who each have produced a brilliant class with young people who would have been in their studios this summer, 2020, but who have gathered with their teachers to give us a really beautiful insight into what happens in the teaching studio. And so I'm delighted to have Elaine and Nancy with me. So I thought I would start Nancy, with a bit of a preview of what you're going to do in your class, which will be Wednesday of this week, August 5th, at 5 p.m. Mountain Time. And you open with your own gorgeous transcription of an Earl Wilde transcription of a Gershwin song. So tell us a little about that.
My teacher at Juilliard was Marcel Grangini, and he used to say about early music, they didn't have our harp, but we have their music. And it's sort of the same with piano repertoire. We're not pianists, but many of us play the piano or learn to play that first, and we steal from the piano repertoire. When I heard this etude of Earl Wilde's, I said, there's gotta be a way to play this on the harp. And I thought it was too difficult, but one of my Aspen fellows, Emily Levine, who's now in Dallas, she said, oh, it's it'd be easy. It lays well in the hands. So, and so I haven't told you yet, but I did it. I learned it. And I just loved the way it felt. So I was trying to play something that was American for this, for our class. And because, since all of my students are going to play works by French composers, I thought it would be more fun to play something really different from the harp repertoire. Although it sounds like it was sort of in the same genre as Clair de Lune, like it might have originally been written for the harp. So that's why I began the class with it, just to, you know, I didn't want to have to play after the students because they're so good.
No, you are dazzling in it. You know, we've never talked about this, but I was a very close friend of Earl's and spent a lot of time with him, especially in his last years. So it was just a treat for me to hear you playing it. So I'm going to go back and forth, if that's okay, which will be, you know, different, but, you know, I think interesting for the listeners. Elaine, your emphasis in your class is on opera, and your expertise in what it takes to be in an orchestra that's playing for singers. And I don't know if you want to say something about that.
Well, when Isidore suggested we make these master classes, he said it would be nice to just invite the audience into your world. And I thought, well, my world is the opera. So yeah, where I know the most, and I thought it would be a good idea to coach the students on opera solos.
And what you emphasize for these young people is you have to know the words. You have to know the story. You have to know what is happening on stage.
You absolutely do, especially now that the audience has subtitles on the back of the seat in front of them. They absolutely know what's going on, even when it's in a foreign language, and you could get it terribly wrong.
Well, going back to Nancy, so you were a student of Grangini, and so this is also one of the great, great traditions in the whole history of harp. What are things from that tradition that you wish always to convey to students?
The first thing is that a harp is a very unified and small world in a way compared to the other instruments. We're very close, and we all the teachers have contact with one another. But we all have different, slightly different ideas, but many of us come from that French tradition that Grangini taught. And the essence of what he gave to me and the essence of what I would want to pass on to my students is all about plucking strings and putting magic into the pluck of how you pluck a string. And it's interesting because, you know, there are many ways to play the harp, and there are many ways to pluck a string. And all of those come into expressive playing, articulate playing, musical playing, rhythmic playing. And a string plucked can sound very different. You can hear one instrument played by many different students and it sounds completely different.
Now, in your class, there's, I think, a beautiful moment when you're asking the student to bring out a melody that was somewhat hidden. Her first performance was fabulous, and it was just beautiful, and so almost anyone would listen to it and go, that's so great. And then you found the one little thing that she could just shed a bit of light on.
My mother used to say always that everything on the harp sounds beautiful. You can't do anything that doesn't sound beautiful. So you can get away with a lot on the instrument and thinks it sounds great. Sort of a mush of two hands playing lots of strings together. But there's also, on the piano, you can hold notes down and you can sustain things with your fingertips. On the harp, it's just like all in the air. So you have to do a lot of manipulation. And that's what we were talking about really with trying to make notes seem like they sustain one to another.
No, Elaine, I was so struck in your teaching by how often you sing. And that this has been a theme. We've been doing, of course, a series of showcases of faculty members and students in all different instruments. And I would say it's a through line to the whole thing. Is how often the piano teacher is singing, the violin teacher is singing, the timpani teacher is singing. But your singing was super expressive. I don't know if you've studied singing.
Thank you. No, in fact, I was one of those people who would never be caught dead singing anything before I got to college. And then I had no control over my voice in ear training class. I used to whistle everything, but you can't on doing that and get curves in notes and vowel and consonant variation. So I got over my hang up about singing. And one thing I've noticed in recording myself and listening to that master class played back is my singing's gotten much better. Some of it sounded pretty okay.
It was super good. And if I may say, also you're conducting, because there are several moments when you are using your hands in the most beautiful gestures.
Thank you. I've also learned not to try to give beats because there's too much delay over Zoom. But if I gesture in a more general way, you know, tell them to go higher and reach farther instead of actually giving beats, that can work on Zoom with the delayed reaction.
Well, I'm so grateful to you, Nancy Allen, Elaine DeVos, beloved members of our faculty in Aspen. Nancy's class is Wednesday, that's August 5th at 5 p.m. Mountain Time. And Elaine's class is going to be on August 22nd, which is a different time than we originally announced, but it will be August 22nd at 5 p.m. Mountain Time. So please look for that. And after their first broadcast, they will also be available online on our website, Facebook and YouTube. So thank you both so much. And now we will turn to Jeremy Denk, who I hope is standing by and ready to join us. There he is.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Jeremy.
How are you?
I am doing great. I hope you are as well.
Yes, not too bad. Considering.
Are you in New York?
I am in New York City right now, yes.
Perfect. And what is happening in your life right now? Do you have some engagements that are happening? Do you have projects? What are you working on?
It's a very good question. I have projects that I'm working on, for sure, and I had a book, you know, that I was supposed to be writing and was due some years ago. So my life after the initial kind of shock wore off and all the concerts more or less vanished through, looks like, January now. I've been practicing things that I really want to practice for the long term, and I've been writing. And both of them are bringing me a lot of satisfaction, so I'm trying to make the best of it.
Huh. Now, is this the book that includes a start you had with a really celebrated New Yorker article about the Ives sonatas and recording them?
This is the second piece that I wrote for them, which was about, I wanted to write a kind of love letter to my teacher in Bloomington, Indiana, a Hungarian guru of the piano named George Sibak, who was kind of a legend among musicians, but maybe not that famous in the wider world. And I, you know, more or less was stunned by him and spent many years there in Bloomington under his spell. And so it's morphed into kind of a bigger story of piano, my different teachers over many years, and painting portraits of them and trying to figure out what I took from each of them and what the problems were, why I couldn't learn certain things at certain times and why I was able to suddenly realize obvious things at certain times. And it's been kind of it's a very personal story and very vulnerable story. And so I'm glad I'm not trying to play concerts while I'm writing it all.
Yeah. Now I feel, of course, you've recorded all the Ives piano sonatas.
Right.
And I feel as though they are insanely difficult. And then the violin sonatas are much nicer. Is that fair?
They are, yeah, especially, well, both piano sonatas are pretty thorny. And Ives often likes to hit you with the most dissonant, ugly parts at the beginning by some perverse element of his nature, you know. But these pieces, you know, they are romantic. You know, the nostalgic part of Ives, the half of him that's, you know, clinging to the past and to beauties of old hymns and ballads and marches and whatever, that part is more evident in these pieces, and the tenderness of it. And I think also the violin brings out something of that too, because there's the fiddling aspect, you know, often, you know, he has all these, and in the barn movement of the second sonata, you know, tremendous fiddle playing that he's sort of transformed into this deranged, mad scherzo. I think the violin helps him also to come down to earth a little bit, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Now, since you said the phrase in the barn, I saw online a funny thing about his manuscripts and that he didn't.
I saw that too. Wait, sorry to interrupt you. I saw that recently too. Yeah.
He kept them in the barn.
Yeah, they were tearing down or selling Ives's house in Reading, which was a terrible shame for many of us. And they reconstructed his studio where he composed, sort of. And the sad part is that he had diabetes starting in 1918 and health problems stemming from that. And he really didn't compose after that. He was more or less done. So he did, by the time he had the house, he didn't really write music anymore. So they reconstructed the studio, but none of his music was in there because he stored all of his scores in the barn with his horse Rocket. Is that the thing that he used?
Yes, exactly.
That's so him, isn't it? It's so, because he loved his music, of course. He was profoundly attached to it, but he would also have thought of it as something not to be put on in a shrine or something like that. He had this weird, you know, different kind of town tinkerer mentality about his work.
So I know Stefan Yakif, who is super well known to our Aspen audience. He's been coming to us since I think he was 11, but he could not join us live today.
Right.
So would you comment on your partnership with Stefan? And you've done the Ives program many places.
Stefan and I have been doing this program for probably 6 years, on and off, here and there. You know, I've met a lot of very gifted violinists in the last 20 or 30 years of my career and played with a lot of them and often try to convince the ones that I really like to try to learn this music, because I think it's important music. It's a really important part of the American classical music heritage. It's a great body of work, and it tells a story, a biographical story that should be found. So I convinced Stefan. I heard Stefan first at the Seattle Chamber Music Festival that we used to both go to, and we played some Brahms together, and we had an affinity. And he's, you know, as you know, incredibly gifted and also smarter than your average bear. And this music takes a little puzzle solving, right, to get it. And he seemed like the perfect person to play it with. So he and I have been doing it for a long time, and he... I have a fond memories of seeing him, because the singers we did it with were often a barbershop quartet. And you'd see Stefan look over at them, and they all had suits, and they had their hymnals, and they would sing the hymns, and then he'd look at me. And there was this moment of sort of, are we playing a concert, or are we preaching a sermon right now? Are we... What is this that we're doing? Yeah.
That's lovely. So I think it's true that at least at Tanglewood you did them in the order of 4-3-2-1.
Yeah.
And now you're leaving out one. How did you make that choice?
Well, to fit it in the time, also number one is the, we always explain that to the audience, that the order 4-3-2-1 is to be helpful to everyone. We'd start with the least threatening, the third is very lovely, the second is a little more thorny, and the first is really a tough nut. It's one of the greatest pieces he ever wrote, I think, but it's also very dense. And also, I think we ended with the one with need, right? The third sonata. And normally we end with one, but right now, I think both Stefan and I felt in this emotional situation, and given the way that our lives are with such uncertainty at the moment, we wanted that sonata. And one of the miracles of that sonata to end is the revelation of the hymn at the end. And I'll explain one boring technical thing to you if you have patience, but, and you know this already, Alan, but Ives basically invented a form of music, you know. The only other example I can think of this form that came before is the Schumann Fantasy for piano, which is, the entire first movement is based on a theme of Beethoven, you know. That theme, right? And so the entire piece is, and only at the end, he gives you the theme. Finally, and everything else in the piece, everything has been this kind of rhapsodic wild variation of the theme, but only at the end do you know what it was all about. And the same thing happens in this sonata, that he's got all these fragments of the hymn, you know, in various ways, different parts of it, different, you know, he takes one part of the hymn and he makes an entire scherzo. He builds a whole like ragtime out of it. And the last movement is all, again, variations of the hymn, and especially these two notes over and over again. Two notes, always these two notes coming at you. And then there's a long ostinato towards the end, a very mysterious and gradually there's this spectacular arrival of the hymn in the violin, playing, you know, like as loud as they possibly can, of course, and the piano surrounding it with tremendous blue notes and wrong notes and every kind of Appalachian waltz. And the violin is just desperate to play the tune for you. And I think both of us felt the need that that be the end of the program right now. Yeah. Even though Ives himself found that piece, it was too beautiful for his taste, you know. He wrote too many pretty things in it, so he was a little ashamed of it. But we're not ashamed of it.
Yeah. No, it's like the piano trio, which is just so full of gorgeous things that you don't.
In that case, Rock of Ages, right, is the tune that comes out. And that's very fortunate because everyone knows that tune still. And so for all of us, that's a kind of beautiful moment.
Beautiful. Well, I think we have a question, and I'm going to turn to Joe Fender, who is our moderator.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. Hello. So James Besser is a professional pianist who's looking for, I guess you'd call it a professional orientation in this time where engagements are not happening. How I guess the question he's asking for advice. Maybe the question is sort of how have you tackled this issue of not having performances anymore?
Yeah, that's a very easy question. sadly, not. I've talked to a lot of people. I myself have focused on some bigger projects and am trying to just wait out until things hopefully return to some semblance of normal. But a lot of people don't have that option right now. And I know a lot of people are doing very creative and entrepreneurial things, you know, creating channels of their work, creating materials around old recordings of theirs, obviously incredible masterclasses. Jan Vogler is doing, in a way, anything to sort of raise an awareness and keep the heartbeat of the music alive. Sorry, I don't know how old the person is who's asking and what situation they're in or what.
Okay, he actually has a clarification here. He says his question was about the challenge of practicing for its own sake without the ultimate goal of public performance.
I'd love to know what Nancy and Elaine would have to say about that. That's they're both muted right now.
Nancy and Elaine, join us. Yeah.
I have a really immediate answer to that is that I might be alone in this, but I love to practice. And I've been waiting for this time period for about 27 years, you know, while I was raising my daughter. And so it's difficult. None of us know if we'll play until next season, you know, at real concerts. I mean, some of us have little concerts here and there, but I just think that it is an incredibly valuable time to be better and to do what you always wanted to do and to make everything sound as good as you can possibly can without the pressure of having to perform it. I think it's fantastic. And I would say that's how I've tackled the loneliness and the solitude of being with my instrument and finally not having to complain about commuting or doing too much work. It's really been a gift, and no one wishes for this kind of a gift, but if ever their time there was like this, it's time to carpe diem and practice.
I'll confess that I, you know, I had this Bach well-tempered clavier project that was supposed to happen when this all went down, and I'd been working on it for a year and a half, and I, you know, was pretty shattered by the vanishing of it, and I couldn't really practice well for a month and a half or so. I would do an hour, maybe at most a day. I would do a little bit, but I felt a little disconnected from the whole thing. And now I feel the opposite. I feel more connected in a way than I've ever been. So, and I'm playing, like Nancy said, things that I love, that I've always wanted to play, that I've needed to do for my own happiness. Schumann and Chopin and things that I'm, and some new pieces that I never dared to have time to learn.
Elaine, what is your practice regimen like?
Well, the first thing I focused on in the pandemic was trying to keep the students on track. I considered them more important and more at risk than myself. I'm hoping I'm still going to have time to practice in the fall, but I signed up immediately for teaching 24 people daily in a series of seminars. And I don't have time to practice. I'm teaching free lessons to all the students who couldn't go back to Aspen this summer, trying to keep all my Juilliard and Madison Bard students on track. And yeah, I hope I have time to practice when summer's over.
Well, the thing about pianists, if I may be reductive, is there is always tons of repertoire to learn.
Oh yeah, I mean, we have an absurd luxury of repertoire.
Well, so many pianists I know have said, I am finally learning X or Y.
So. Yeah, no, I'm learning at least four different pieces that I'm learning Handel, weirdly, which I never had any. But one student was playing Handel, and I was like, well, this is amazing music at the keyboard, and it's completely different from Bach, even though it comes from the same time. And, you know, that's a great gift for me, and a way to keep myself from going crazy. The students, I worry about them too, but I have to say the ones I saw, they seem to be pretty diligent in this moment also. More diligent than I have been, yeah.
Well, it links to a thing we did a few weeks ago with Daniel Trifonoff and Bach, and then James Ennis and Andrew Armstrong and Elisa Wallerstein and Iman Barnaton on Beethoven. But Handel's influence on Beethoven is huge.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, I think once you start getting into Handel from that point of view, you see tons of stuff in Beethoven.
It's more operatic than Bach is, yeah. Right? Yeah. So the gestures are more stylized and a little bit more extroverted, but the subtleties are huge under the surface. Yeah, but it's a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. Super. So I see a question. Maybe Joe will.
We have, there's a comment that basically amplifying what our guests are saying, just as an amateur, just as a chance to build literacy. There is one other question about the IVE studio, Jeremy, if you happen to know where that reconstruction is, and if it's if you can walk in.
I believe you still can. I'm not totally sure, but it was the American Academy of Arts and Letters that they reconstructed it. And they even put a little fake window in there with the view of what I would have seen. And, there's a picture in the New York Times article about it when they reconstructed it. And that's it's a beautiful picture, and I recommend.
So that's up in the Bronx, I think.
It's on 155th and Broadway, so not quite the Bronx, sort of Washington Heights.
Okay, yeah. So way up.
A good city bike trip for me, but...
sort of like Fritz Kreisler's studio, which now exists entire in the middle of the Colburn School in Los Angeles.
Is that true? Oh, that's yes. Amazing. Yeah.
Yes.
Was he living in LA before that at all?
The studio was at his house in Beverly Hills, and then the house was sold, and some smart people said he had it as a little cottage on the property. Mm-hmm. They said, let's just take it. And when they built the Colburn School, they put it right in the middle.
Right, right. Oh, that's incredible. There are all these amazing people, of course, who lived in LA, right? Like, you know, Adorno even lived in LA for all.
Yeah.
God's sake. And there's this great short story by Jeff Dyer about going, he wanted to go see Adorno's house, and he knocks on the door, and there's this like little yoga person, you know, in like a spandex, you know, and she answers the door, and she's like, he tells her that it was Adorno, so she's like, oh, cool. And then there's this whole, like, cultural clash that happens in the Adorno's house. Schoenberg, of course, Stravinsky, all those people, yeah.
Yeah. No, actually, I might get the story a little wrong, but I think it's exactly right. Roger Sessions told me this, that he was in L.A. and he was visiting Stravinsky. And in those days, you could only visit one of them. You could not visit Schoenberg and Stravinsky because they knew who was doing what.
Yes.
So you could only go for one. But he was going to visit Stravinsky, and he knocked on the door of a house in the Hollywood Hills, and this guy in tennis whites, very athletic, answered, and Sessions said, oh no, I was hoping to meet Mr. Stravinsky. And the guy says, oh, is that the Russian guy? He lives across the street.
Yeah, there it is. It's like, no matter how famous you are in California, it's sort of a great equalizer, right?
Yes. Okay, well, I want to say thank you to Elaine DeVos, Nancy Allen, Jeremy Denk. So Elaine's class is August 22nd, I think at 5 p.m. Mountain Time. Nancy's is this Wednesday, August 5th, also 5 p.m. Mountain Time. Jeremy and Stefania O'Keefe are playing three Charles Ives violin sonatas, fabulous program, this coming Sunday at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. So please join us for all of that, and thank you.
Thank you all.